by saying actually that I don't really know Neil White. What I do know, I really enjoyed, because the first time I met Neil, I think we spent about an hour and a half just talking, and the things that I've really enjoyed about what I know about Neil are really to do with approach, and that's why I departed from here. I really like the approach. I really like the approach to art that is about the way that I see it, about how art thinks, and the way I see Neil's interdisciplinary associative approach is that it really explores ideas about not just about methods, but also about the way the world and its methods interact. And so selfishly, I really wanted to invite Neil here just to have a really good discussion about where his work is and what those approaches are, because I think it touches on more or less everything that we're now interested in ICFAR: processes, practices, spaces, sites, archives, and the way in which artists' methods really inform how we might actually change the whole kind of nature of what we see as research. So given that, that big introduction, Neil might like to just speak to that. But in actual fact, I just really wanted Neil to come here and talk about the projects that he's been doing and his approaches, which many of us have been receiving little kind of epiphanies from over the email. So Neil, please.
Thank you. Nice. Well, thanks for that. That seems like quite an ambitious thing. I think you've pressed all of those things. But I'll give it a try, actually. So I've kind of structured a talk around the work that I've made, and it comes in four sections. So I was kind of planning to speak about probably about 40 minutes. See how that goes. But feel free to interrupt at any point if you have questions, because I'm sure the field gets quite complicated. No, that's fine. So my name's Neil White. Just for today, I'm going to have just one role, because I have seem to have too many roles. So I'm just initiator of the Office of Experiments. I want to start off by introducing what that is, what that means. And it's really, it embodies my practice, but it also embodies my research. The two things aren't separated in terms of the way I work, unlike, I guess, many people who have two separate fields that are related. Mine seem to intertwine. So what I wanted to kind of just give you the background of the idea, the aim of the Office Experiment, which is this idea to draw on that idea of what is experimental, the idea that it's a critical practice, it's also a process. But it also embodies a whole kind of field of research, of work that's happened on the margins of research, of history, of in all fields, actually. And that kind of is the focus of this idea of the Office of Experiments. I think when I'm thinking about experiments, I just kind of like to qualify that, because I think it's one that says the name experiment, one can think, oh yes, laboratory, studio, maybe an experimental practice. But there's a fantastic department at the Max Planck Institute called the Department of History of Science and Ideas, and run by Dr. Rayberger, and he says this about, this is from a talk called The Shape Experiment. We talked about experiment not in terms of this closed, inside a closed structure, but in terms of a kind of socio-technological experiment, that is, putting it outside of the laboratory and putting it into society on a scale of 1-to-1. And it refers to Bruno Latour's theories of actor network theory, with lots of actors working within this experiment. So I really kind of favour that idea of the experiment. And the images that you see behind will come up again, so I'll kind of elucidate what those are. So the idea is that it's a self-instituted organisation, basically, which I created around 2004. And its idea is to have simultaneous temporary models of collaboration. That is, I work on multiple projects with many people. And each one of those projects has different disciplines involved in it. And that's for a number of reasons. One, because it allows us to be collaborative together and share a name. So I kind of passed over using my own names, I felt comfortable. But it also, you know, gives us a more dynamic network kind of structure. I put a whole bunch of words, as I said, that kind of cover the areas that I'm interested in. I'm not going to talk about all those in detail, but just give you an idea of some of the language and some of the classifications that you could apply to the areas that I'm interested in. But of course, you know, working within the idea of setting up an institution comes from a model which itself is related to the institution which does research and the institutions that we all might work in as researchers. And I guess as part of that, it would come from what quite neatly is, I think, a really good summary by Maria Lindt. I can't read that at the bottom, actually, but it's from the United Nations Plaza, which is a kind of summary of the four ways of institutional critique, which I find a really kind of compelling summary. And this idea, particularly in the fourth way, of starting pseudo-institutions. And with this in mind, I will talk later, I'll kind of return to it at the end, but people like Jakob Jakobsen at Copenhagen Free University has spoken very well about this phenomenon. Surely you're aware of it. I mean, I think one of the differences, the third and the fourth wave, is that almost in the third wave you have that action of the experiment happening, or the institutional play, but it's still happening inside the institution. Only in this fourth wave it really becomes autonomous. So what I wanted to talk about is there's kind of four sections. So I'll try and be brief within each of them and then summarise them at the end in the potential structures. And this is just kind of gives a bit of a history to my work as well, as explaining some of the origins of why I work in the way I do and who I've worked with. And I wanted to start off with this idea of the self-experimenter. And it kind of follows on from my interest in the self-experimenter is kind of interest in institutions, ethics, risk, the limits of institutions and the things that you can do within institutions. And I started working in, particularly in scientific institutions and artists around about 98 actually, but 99 fully as a resident. And I worked at the Human Genome Mapping Project, which at the time was an incredibly dull project actually. It was just lots of machines processing because the mapping was not complete. So there's lots of activity, and what I was kind of really interested in was all these scientists who were working on this material that had incredible resonance for the whole of society. And so what I did is I kind of immersed myself and started intervening in the space, and I started telling stories about my own background and Clapton adoption, which I distributed through the post, and it caused lots of problems. And then I did this project which I asked for people to send in give me photographs of themselves and allow me, I directly asked them if I could manipulate their image. And kind of spoke to them about this idea of manipulating things in the way that genetics does, manipulating code. So this was just an early project, but it kind of gives an idea of that intervention. But through this project, one of the really interesting things that happened was I started working with an author called Lawrence Norfolk, who's written a few books. Lompierre's Dictionary and Pope's Rhinoceros, kind of historical fiction, conception based. And together we worked on a play which was about a geneticist and a patient, and a geneticist trying to find out about their illness. And what it really was about was these models of knowledge and models of engagement. And so we wrote this circular play which was a kind of dance between this genetic scientist and meeting somebody in a clinical setting, and that person trying to find out. And that piece was eventually elaborated into this structure in a show. It was shown in the Human Genome Mapping Project gallery, but also shown at Art Lab, which was happening at Imperial College 2001. So in this structure, you have this dialogue going on. And this architectural, semi-architectural model represents this kind of closure between these two different dialogues that are happening, and there's speakers embedded in this object. But this is quite interesting because this was the first show in the new gallery of Imperial College, and I think they're all expecting lots of illustrations of scientific slides. So it was something of a shock to kind of enter into this space with this quite tense dialogue going on. And that project with Lawrence led on to this book, which is kind of important for a number of reasons, which become clear later, but it's a book called Ot Sneed. And I guess it's my first delving into the archives, really. And what the book is it takes a moment in the history of media, I suppose, which is Thomas Edison's image. This is the first piece of copyrighted film ever made. And it was made in a huge camera, and it's of his assistant, Fred Ott Sneezing. And what Lawrence and I did was we decided to recreate this book. So I'm just going to show you a short film. I warn you, it happens very quickly. It's very short. That is in fact much shorter than it looks, strangely. That is in fact a 1 second sneeze. And it was shot on a very high speed camera that takes 1024 frames per second in a laser laboratory in Oxford. I had to actually sneeze through a small hole into the beam of the laser without blinding myself, because one strobe of the beam of the laser is enough to blind you, and it strobes at 25,000 times per second. So it's a little bit hazardous. An enormous rig we had to build just to see through the small hole. But actually that film is an artifact of the book, and the book itself constitutes just frames from that 1 second. So the book is actually just 1 second. And it's an examination of that relationship in time that happens in the 1 second. And this project led on, I guess, to this idea of self-experimentation, and this is where, you know, the trajectory really takes us to. And this project called Let's Experiment With Ourselves, suggestive title, but I was interested in the unspoken aspects of research that seem to go on in these scientific institutes that people wouldn't talk to me about. And one of those was self-experimentation, kind of, you know, a well documented, but not really actually as well documented as it should be, method that's used in science. And what I decided to do is I had this residency at National Institute of Medical Research, and I was very interested in this piece of work that Eve Klein had done. In fact, it was not actually a piece of work, it was an opening of his exhibition called Le Vide in 1958. And during this, he gave out a cocktail, a clear cocktail, that people drank, and during the course of the evening thought nothing of it. I'll explain the effect. But it's mildly toxic, and it produces, the stream of urine to become blue, deep time blue, of course. So what I tried to do was try and see if I could do this at the National Institute of Medical Research as a piece of research, recreate it and see if it was possible. And of course they said, well, yes, it's possible, but if you're using human subjects, then you're going to have to go through the ethics committee. And I think, you know, there's something in linguistic research. These kinds of issues come up. So I think they thought that were going to stop me, but it didn't. I got in touch with some pharmacists, and within about a week, we managed to write a clinical trial based on some templates. We submitted the clinical trial, and guess what? I think you might be pleased to hear it was turned down. their reason for turning it down was it was turned down on cultural grounds. Because the experiment was proposed as a cultural experiment rather than a clinical experiment, and they couldn't rule on anything that wasn't clinical, even though it had a clinical base. So we wanted to find out what the effect of this cocktail was. So they kind of said to me, well, I got a couple of them into a room to have this informal discussion in the ethics committee. Well, why did we not get it? And they explained, well, we know it's not really harmful, but you know, actually we're coming up for funding, and if the government sees that we're kind of allowing this kind of stuff, good. So, you know, the usual institutional politics. But their answer was, well, why don't you just go and do it in an art gallery? They don't seem to care. which we all know not to be true now, because these art institutions are as bound up by health and safety as everybody else is. But actually, we thought, actually, we'll go and try it. And so we did this performance called The Void in a number of places. And you turned up to The Void, there was a paper which you can kind of make out that's on that crate. And what you would do as a participant actually in this project was you read the paper which would tell you about the pill that I had that I was preparing inside, which was a limited edition artwork, and you could exchange a receipt with your name on it for the pill through the chamber. And so I was just signing and giving out these limited edition artworks. Of course it said, whatever you do, don't consume the pill. Although only mildly toxic, also explained all of the issues, likely issues. At that point, you had the decision. You either kept this thing as an art object, you know, viewed this thing as an art object for its potential value in the future, or you consumed it against the guys. I don't know what happened to all these people, but some people started sending me images. So this is some of the data produced from that particular experiment. It did cause stream urine to turn blue for about 3 to 4 days. This kind of line of self-experimentation I've kind of recently, it's sort of coming to an end, but with this project called the Truth Serum, which features this kind of cipher for the office of experiments called the Incredible Randy, who operates in a space between the participants and the experiments. And this particular experiment was conducted at FACT in Liverpool at the beginning of the year. And consisted of an installation. So what you're seeing here is an installation in the gallery which has concealed space. So the print of Randy that you can see and the text that you can see on the back wall introduces you to an idea of taking part, of being a participant in self-experimentation. If you can't see it in the corner, you've bleached out in the slide, but if you entered into a kind of concealed door, you've entered into this sub-chamber. In that space, it was possible to sign up to take part in an experiment. That experiment was to do with truthfulness and truth serums, and was particularly, it was made as a way of raising attention about Steve Kurtz, who some of you may, I hope you will know, arrested in America for research. was basically conducting research into biotechnology. I did a show with him back in 2003 at Natural History Museum. It was nothing serious. So anyway, this project was kind of dedicated to that. And I'm just going to show now a little footage of what actually happened in this experiment. So what you're seeing, and you're going to see, is the participants in the experiment. And what they did was they volunteered on a day to come to the gallery at an allotted time, and then they were, for all intents and purposes, kidnapped with permission. And they were taken in the back of the car to an undisclosed space where they were kind of put through a series of rooms, a kind of form of psychological torture, I guess, or interrogation, you could call it. It's a performance in which they were kind of the performer. And ultimately it led to this experiment. So this is a compilation. Code is black on a white background is true, white on a black background is false. So this was a kind of, I'll talk through, this is just a compilation, but I'll talk through the end of it. So this test ran for about 10 minutes per person, and was the kind of final stage of this experiment. And it's based on a neuropsychological test called the Stroop test, which operates on an area of the brain called the conflict area, where it places two systems into shock. So what you have is, particularly with, I think the best illustration is that the sentence you probably noted some time back, which says blue is a word, not a colour. What that does is it brings in your system of language against your system that deals with colour, and the conflict part of the brain tries to resolve it one way or another. And you can shift this neuropsychologically, you can shift this test so that you can give somebody a moral dilemma or say something morally outrageous, and it also has this problem, this conflict zone comes into operation. And by timing responses, you can actually work out whether people are telling the truth or not. So that was the experiment, or that's part of the experiment. The other part was that actually each of the participants was also offered to become part of a different control group. So you'll just see behind the ear of this guy a small patch. That's actually his travel sickness patch. It's no longer strictly allowed in the country. But they were the control group, and this is a drug called scopolamine. And it's the same drug used by the CIA and the FBI in their interrogation techniques. So the speculation was that Steve Kurtz might also have encountered it. So anyway, that was this trajectory of self-experimentation. The other parts, hopefully I'll cover a bit more quickly. Are there any questions about that? Okay, I'll carry on.
That's fascinating.
So the second thing I wanted to kind of talk about was around, I guess, before this piece was done actually, but around 2004-2005, I was asked to kind of look at this, the idea of space and space exploration, space research, and I kind of really wasn't particularly hugely engaged with the idea of space. It was just not my thing. I kind of thought it was a terrible waste of money sending people off, particularly this is a response to Bush's idea to invest millions, which now they're sort of folly, into going to Mars. What I did do was I approached a group that I was very interested in collaborating with, and this project marks the kind of, this is the birth where Otto Experiments was born. And this group called M55, based in Copenhagen. And together we decided to create a research station based on Earth, which is why it's called the Space on Earth Station. And our idea was to kind of take some of the models, these knowledge transfer models, which is where the word comes from, I think, you know, of creating non-stick saucepans from the Teflon coating on the outside of the spaceship. But to take some of this idea and see if we could put it to more useful ends, i.e. by looking at communal spaces and communal living and experiments for kind of new possibilities of occupying the Earth without having massive impact. So we created this multi-module station and invited artists to work on it. And we had about five or six artists' projects that ran on the space. And this was up at Camden Roundhouse. And so we had people like Marcus Ahlers from Berlin, who was building solar ovens. We had numerous test vehicles being constructed. Kel Brandon, who works with Heath Bunting sometimes, who was building an additional module out of a skip. You see a small bird village created from estate agent signs, so housing for the birds. We had B modules, we had various kinds of transportation systems, recycling, scrap materials. But this whole project, which, you know, lasted, I guess, in research and development for about 3 years, was actually only on for 6 days. So it was kind of a big learning curve. I know we all have learning curves, but this idea of temporary structures, I think I've had readjusted my approach since. But I was kind of, you know, this idea of a light footprint, of a research station that can land somewhere and then move on. And I've kind of taken this idea further. So this is just a snapshot from a very recent project. This is at the Centre for Land Use Interpretation this summer. And this structure, which actually is based on the structures behind it, is part of a project it's funded by the Henry Moore Foundation. And I was out there for some time building this and moving it around. And it will feature in a couple of projects that are being done at the moment that aren't completed. So this is in fact, you'll see the small structure there, this is in fact the edge of the Dugway Proving Ground. This is the largest chemical and biochemical testing and bombing range in the world. And this particular research centre that CLUI, Centre for Land Use Interpretation, run is right bang between two of the biggest bombing ranges in the world. So there are lots of artists there doing projects. And I managed to get onto the bombing ground to do that piece. So these projects, one's called Experiment E, which is actually stands for Evanometry versus Entropy, which is the ideas of Smithson and Latham that come together in a performance idea. But also a film about asymmetric aesthetics, which is really, it's a war film with no war imagery that I'm working on. But that unit is called the Futility Unit, the Field Utility Unit, and it will be kind of, it's been disseminated in the form of an artist page for this show coming up at Pompidou in Paris in February. But it's also going to feature, hopefully, we haven't had a full date when Camberwell Space is opening, but when we've got that confirmed, it will also feature one or two or three of these units with being inhabited by a Mongol project looking at surveillance systems. So I'm kind of interested in this idea of, I guess, structures, which temporary structures, which also become platforms for research, which I hope speaks to kind of some of these ideas of where work is made and how work is made. I think it's really important to talk about archives, as it kind of seems to be one of the major themes and one of the things I seem to be heavily embedded in within the Office of Experiments. And in terms of a kind of theoretical framing, or a framing that I really enjoy and suits the way that I work, which I think is some way that theory fits with practice, is the paper by Hal Foster, The Archival Impulse, when he kind of really has explored the idea of the archive as, well, in terms of entropy, is in terms of a place where things go to, I guess, slowly rot, you know, and the entropic relation to them is that condition is halted in as many ways as possible, but the object document is preserved. And so it's all about stasis in many ways. So I kind of like the way that that's explored, and I also love this idea that he talks about when he says that, you know, these are, in archaeological time terms, could be considered excavation sites when you go into them as an artist and explore them. But they also become construction sites where you can build new projects and build meaning, and that sort of really resonated with me. So in terms of my own projects, because I haven't just worked in science spaces or into those purely interdisciplinary science and art spaces, but also in art institutions, and some early work I did, I guess, with the Henry Moore Institute and the project I'm going to talk about, I was kind of thinking about events in relationship to the archive, which also comes up again in a later project. But this idea of events over objects and how events appear in the archive, and what happens to documents or collections which are erased, you know, those different events that act upon the archive before it's aggregated into a collection. How can the archive represent an event itself over an object? You know, does it just simply document papers, or can it document something else? And what, particularly in relationship to this project, happens if you create a false event inside an archive? So when I was doing space on the Earth Station, I was also working on this project called The Third Campaign. And I was invited by Henry Moore Institute Leeds to look into their archive and particularly look at the relationship of their archive to British sculpture in London in the 20th century. So they gave me a big list, and I went around and looked at lots of buildings. I kind of was really engaged, I guess, through the controversy of this building on the Strand, which Jacob Eckstein installed this very famous frieze. And the history behind this is that he created this frieze in 1908, this frieze of sculptures for the British Medical Association building. There was a big campaign not to allow them to go up because a lot of them were naked and they were deemed to be very shocking, and the Evening Standard led the campaign. Eckstein was successful despite various big institutions weighing in against him. But when the British BMA building was sold in 1935 to the South Rhodesian Embassy, they said, okay, we don't want this frieze, we're going to remove it. And there was another campaign, a second campaign. This is what Eckstein himself referred to as the 30-year war. Which he again won, but in fact interesting things happened, like the Royal Academy refused to support his campaign, which is an interesting fact because in fact within the will of Henry Moore, no works of Henry Moore's are allowed to be shown in the Royal Academy as a result of that particular refusal. If you ever wondered why you haven't seen any Henry Moore there. But it was a very contentious campaign and successful. 2 years later, however, when they were taking down the bunting for the coronation, they set up a scaffolding, and while they were at it, they decided to hack the whole thing up with some hammers and chisels. And so they basically destroyed this frieze. But you can see it, it's still there opposite Charing Cross Station. So I decided that what I'd do was start a campaign to restore these, this moment, this event that happened to these sculptures. And so I made a film. I kind of lobbied outside the building itself for 3 weeks, and a film is made of that. And then also wrote to everybody that was involved, like the Evening Standard at the time, International Heritage, and ended up appearing on Front Row with Richard Court to discuss the campaign. Of course, it was a fictitious campaign. I had absolutely no intention of reinstating the sculptures. What I was really interested in happening was what happens if I tried to create a false archive and insert that into the existing archive to add it into this kind of contentious series of interventions with that work. And so what at the end of that work, a piece, so this was the show that was at the Henry Moore Institute, and here you can see actually these are on the wall, you'll see the original photographs of the pieces when they were made in Eckstein's studio before they were destroyed. And in fact, these are very rarely seen. So this piece, it was kind of really about this insertion into the archive and to interrupt its possibilities, but also kind of reimagine what was possible in terms of this work. And the invigilators kind of walked around once. So we had quite a lot of people on the campaign, and so the campaign now consists of the letters and the campaign and the artifacts inside the Henry Moore Institute collection. Just around this time, I went to a manifesto meeting, coffee morning. I presented some of the work and had a bit of an argument with them about hospitality and guests and this idea of hospitality. But as a result of that discussion, somebody said to me, you should go meet John Latham and Barbara Sabini, who live not too far from where I live. And so I duly kind of contacted them and went over with lots of stories about how interesting meeting it could possibly be. And John, who is the now Lowick Professor of Flat Time at the University of Arts in England. So I met him in Flat Time House, which is now open to the public, I hope. But get down there. But I met him and I left a book, the Oxnese book, with him. And we discussed some ideas, and I wasn't kind of sure where it went, and I really wasn't clear. And in fact, I wasn't actually that sure about a lot of John's work at that time. But in any case, I left that book with him. And then about a week later, I got a call from him, and he said, you understand flat time theory, you have to come over and discuss it, which was kind of a call I couldn't refuse. I had no idea what Slaptime theory is at that time, so I went over and he kind of showed me, amongst other things, he showed me this, which is probably one of the most important pieces of discoveries of process in his development of his Slaptime theory, which is a 1 second drawing of the spray can. And of course, you know, the link with the 1 second sneeze was kind of pretty clear to me. And so we discussed lots of things, and he explained to me ideas to do with evanoitry, and I kind of, in a way, I got it. I don't think anybody can actually say they get all of Joel Aiken's theories, and I think that's part of the point of them, that you're not able to get them. But I certainly got some of them, and I think one of the really, you know, this kind of idea of events and event structure really struck me. And it was so resonant. It's been so resonant for so many artists, and I think that's how they've come to it, you know, come to it and taken something away. This idea of event structure, that forget objects, you know, the idea of a structure coming together, an artist being able to mould a structure, which they call an art object, is kind of what it's all about. And this idea of everything then dissolving, and that language was no longer, you know, is not entirely suitable in terms of the way that knowledge is thought about, developed, the way that we think about art and science. So many things seem to resonate, and we got on. So we started to work on a couple of projects. Some of those are still strangely ongoing, despite the fact that John actually died in 2006, very sadly, just shortly after we had made a decision on what we were going to do. But I've since kind of stayed around Slaptime House and worked with Barbara, because as well as working with John, I was also invited to become a member of the board of O&I. And so I've kind of hung around and seen the transformation of his house from his kind of home and living quarters to what is now a Slaptime House, supported by the Latham Estate, the Listening Gallery, and by the HRC to Alictus project, which I just mentioned. And who? Yeah, Anthony here. We might want to talk about it at some point. you look worried now. So just a few shots, and this is a few shots of the opening show, Distress of the Dictionary, which shows some of the spaces. And in fact, we have a rival event tonight, which you should all actually be at, but which is down in Peckham, in Time and Language, which is showing some time-based works, particularly in relationship to John's stuff. But I think, you know, this is really exciting. It's really exciting being around the house, and the projects that are evolving. I think for me, whilst there's this emphasis on the house and the display of objects, for me the really exciting thing is this project. This is the HLC funded one, which is to do with archive and event, and I'm sure it makes sense as to why I'd be interested in that. And this is looking out, I think I might be finished, it's looking out from inside the archive out to the possible future, and whilst Anthony and Thanasis are working on this project, I'm also interfacing them with them as I occupy a space at the back of this house. The Office of Experiments is kind of in discussion with them about the ways of which systems, maybe even spatio-temporal systems, could be used to display the archive, to open it up. And that idea of opening the archive up is something that, again, I've been really interested in for some time and tried to do when looking at projects with Tate archives and the APG archive. And I think really well summarised. I think I'm probably going to natter too long, so I'm just going to speed up. APG, I'm sure most people know, but just to recap, formed in 1966 by Barbara Savini and John, and joined by a kind of a list of eminent names and further names who then kind of went on to intervene in industry and government and all kinds of places, creating fantastic projects. Hugely influential in my eyes, really changed the way in which one thought about the spaces in which it was possible to make art, taking art out of society, kind of, I guess, starting the curve of socially engaged practice. But what really fascinates me about the APG archive is it contains, it's in its own by Tate at the moment, I've been working with them for a couple of years on ways in which we might open this up. is its methods and methodologies and how those are appropriate to the way that we work now, particularly when thinking about archives. It's a kind of almost self-reflexive project, and we've discussed the archival placement, in fact, so it's kind of using their own technique to work inside the archive itself. But this is the methodology, and I think some of the really important methodologies that came out that were later abandoned in what we know as residencies now, which say point five there, that the status of the artist within the organisations is independent, autonomous. The status of the artist in the organisation is in line with other professional persons, i.e. if you're going to work with the ICI, you work out whoever's paid the most in the ICI, if that's what they value most, the bottom line, then you make sure the artists get paid at that rate. Those kinds of ideas, whether they were successful, it was this idea that you valued the artist and the artist's contribution was valued, and what you did was you worked out the system by which they valued that contribution and matched it accordingly. And I've been working with people like Critical Practice in order to kind of carry on some of those discussions that come out of APG's practice and the continuous practice of ONI, and to discuss ideas of art and value. And this is an event called Between that we held at South London Gallery, in between the John Martin Arm Lader exhibition and the following exhibition, in which we occupied the space and talked about ideas of autonomy. I kind of skimmed over quite a bit, but I thought we could go back. Do you have any questions after this? So last day I just wanted to talk about was potential structures and try and summarise some of the things that I've been talking about in relationship to my own approach to research and institutions and dealing with knowledge structures. And I kind of have to go back to the idea of the temporary structure and this idea of institutional critique, because as an artist engaged in research, you know, it's one of those points of stress at which I decide whether my research fulfills an AHRC criteria remit of research, or whether it sits fully within practice, or it's practice as research, and the tension between those things. And that really kind of explains, you know, the office experiments gives me a home and gives others a home through which to kind of not worry so much about those institutional guidelines and maybe push the boundaries on ethics and other ways of working. I kind of returning to, you know, these kinds of very black and white statements, but nonetheless, you know, really resonant about the way in which institutions are able to adopt the work of the avant-garde and kind of make them, through a paradigm shift, almost powerless, almost immediately. You know, young artists certainly are being adopted into institutions almost instantaneously, it's been argued by people like Dave Beach. And I think that's true. So how does one resist that? Well, this idea of self-institutionalisation, you know, is not my own, and I thought it was a really good strategy. So, in many ways, it also resonates with this idea of experiment being more than just a closed thing, and it's something that Artist Placement Group does. This idea of producing social relations as a form of aesthetics, that the experiment could enter into that idea, and whether it might be through a knowledge structure, something that project's based on, or whether it's a social exchange. And historically, you know, there's all kinds of models that I've been interested in teaching and looking at over years, and some of those are really coming into kind of focus at the moment. I won't run through all of those, but I think people will be familiar with some of the recent ones. Perlarth Catalogue, for me, is a really great and interesting starting place for Stuart Brand, who then went on to start the Whole Earth Electrical Lexicon and then started the magazine Wired, but really dealt with access to tools and started in 1966, you know, which was a kind of forerunner of, I guess, social networking today. But all these models, in a way, which are dealing with research but also dealing with ways in which social exchange can take place and transformations can take place. And that kind of goes back to also my thinking about the reason that I was interested in self-experimental was this idea of transformation and where transformation starts. And I think it starts with individuals engaging in social exchange or participating in groups, but also in these quasi-institutions that have started. And some of the other ones that have been, I guess, I'd say been modelled, used as a model, the Centre for Land Use Interpretation that I mentioned, Museum of Jurassic Technology, which is also in Los Angeles, shares a building with the Centre for Land Use, as does, you can't quite read it, the Institute for Figuring, who did a recent exhibition at Hayward Gallery on hyperbolic crochet. Everybody saw that. It's called Coral Reef, but it's a really interesting project based around women's groups creating crochet reefs. There's actually the Institute for Figuring. You can't read it, I'm afraid. Actually, I wondered, actually, there's a thing in a vitrine in the corner which is like a crocheted reef as well. So I wondered if it was them, but I don't think it is. But they actually would sit very well in here, I think. But these institutions, and Institute for Figuring, Centre for Land Use, are exploring very specific ideas. Institute for Figuring is looking at the representation of mathematics, and that's all it looks at. So its interventions with hyperbolic crochet are to do with hyperbolic space and its representation. And in fact, crochet is the only way you can represent hyperbolic space, interestingly. Cabinet Magazine, which we'll be familiar, and also, you know, journals like Implicosphere, which Sarah O'Reilly ran, and which is recently coming to an end. But I was kind of, you know, tying it back to things like spatio-temporal aesthetics, that one of those words I mentioned earlier on. This is one of the things that I do love about what the Centre for Land Use Interpretation does. And part of what I do when I go and create a project is I'm also studying the model of the place in which I'm working. And what really compels me about the Centre for Land Use Interpretation is the way in which they take knowledge outside of institutions, those institutions that whose boundaries we understand in certain ways. And in some ways they also kind of model themselves upon it. So this is, the bottom slide is their headquarters in Los Angeles. And you'll see each one of those monitors is an exhibition, an entire photographic exhibition. So they'll have like 12 exhibitions running simultaneously. Then they do this spatial temporal term comes from their bus tours. In fact, that's just what they call their bus tours. So they take people out on tours of the land and take them to interesting sites in the States. And I kind of, this idea of being mobile, of knowledge being mobile and being located is, again, something I find really compelling. This, how do you deal with, you know, how do you deal with the archive in terms of process and documents? Barbara Savini tomorrow and Friday will be continuing her series of walks called I Am an Archive, which also I think is it's kind of in a way a solution to this problem with a similar strategy. It's a mobile, these walks. And as she says, which take the practice outside of institutions and into the public spaces and social exchange in which APG and ONI itself. So it kind of really cites the knowledge where it should be rather than in this kind of very removed, sanctified research space. In terms of my own projects, I'm also working on this project, which will be at one of the iterations of which will be at John Hansard Gallery next September. And it's actually a series of projects that started called Overt Research Projects by the Office of Experiments. And in this particular team, the team is at the bottom. We have people I'm working with people directly from Centre for Land Use Interpretation. Who are kind of guiding me on their own models and the way that they build. But this is going to be a research database and an exhibition based around hidden spaces of research in the UK. Sounds very dry, but it's amazing what's out there already. And that slide in the background is actually the entrance way to the Dugway Proving Ground, I guess, in America, an example of what the Centre for Land Use have done with this kind of area. So it's an ongoing project that I'm doing with UCL, which should probably last 2 to 3 years. I just thought I'd include this because I spoke to John Latham about books and knowledge quite a bit, and I kind of always asked him in his book works, his destructive book works, you know, whether the title was relevant, and he said that he felt that this was his most with best title you've ever found and the most relevant title to the way in which you work with books, and I think particularly relevant in terms of where we're thinking about research, this idea that you can reduce everything to books and knowledge in terms of the written word and the printed word being his kind of criticism, but also his material through which he engaged in ideas of knowledge production. And I think, you know, one of the things that's really exciting that just ties it all up finally is something that Elisa, who's also the curator at Flat Time House, and Anthony here particularly started, initiated, was this discussion of how do we take these ideas that John Latham had back out, and taking what I've just talked about in terms of spatial temporal dynamics and the idea of something light and non-institutional. We've decided to start the Know It School, which will be announced, I guess, more fully in the coming weeks. But which is, the idea is to run courses at Flat Time House in and around John Latham's ideas, maybe exploring those kind of dimensions of social engagement, but also to do with the ideas of flat time theory, but also to do with other people who are able to come in and talk about their own projects in relation to those. And it was originally imagined as a kind of rural school in Peckham by Anthony, which I thought was fantastic, but has now elaborated into the Know It School. And the Know It is a term that John Latham coined to refer to knowledge. And I think, just to put on the last slide, in terms of, you know, the contribution and the way in which knowledge works, and the way, the thing that I'm interested in, I think this sentence summarizes it pretty nicely. That's all I've got.
Oh, that was fantastic. Thoroughly absorbing. Can we just have a little break?
Just
like, sort of gather around with the page of the chairs a bit and just talk about some of those things. I'd love to also hear from Anthony and other people. So it doesn't need to be kind of question and answer, but so many things come out of that. Is that right?